I am very happy to stand before you today. We are continuing in our study of the fourfold Gospels, and today I will be covering the topics assigned to me, which are on the board up above or the TV behind me, which are the Transfiguration of Jesus, Jesus healing the demoniac boy, Jesus returning to Galilee, and his foretelling of his death and resurrection. A while ago, Matt had found an excellent resource online called the Composite Bible, and I really like using this, and so I'm going to use it once again so that all the verses are kind of merged together so we can get a more complete picture. So this afternoon, we're going to start off with the Transfiguration of Jesus, and you can see the verses up there, but it's found in three parts or three sections, Matthew 17, Mark 9, and Luke 9. So, beginning, after 6 or about 8 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and brought them up into a high mountain privately by themselves to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and he was changed into another form in front of them. He was transfigured. His face shone like the sun, and his garments became as white as the light and dazzling, exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. Behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them talking with Jesus, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. It happened as they were parting from him that Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here. If you want, let's make 3 tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. For he didn't know what to say, for they were very afraid. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered into the cloud. Behold, a voice came out of the cloud, saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and were very afraid. When the voice had finished, Jesus came and touched them and said, "Get up and don't be afraid." Suddenly looking around and lifting up their eyes, they saw no one with them anymore except Jesus. As they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Don't tell anyone what you saw until the Son of Man has risen from the dead." They were silent and told no one in those days any of the things which they had seen. They kept this saying to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead meant. What has transpired here in these collection of verses are some of the most incredible and remarkable events, I believe, in the New Testament. When I read these verses and I try to place myself in those disciples' shoes, even my imagination falls short at what actually occurred upon that mountaintop. I imagined it was incredible and terrifying all at the same time. This awe-inspiring event for these disciples has occurred 6 to 8 days after Peter made his confession and affirmation of Jesus, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." I say 6 to 8 days because Matthew and Mark both record 6 days, but Luke records about 8. Despite what might be a discrepancy, their timelines actually line up and are accurate because Luke included the day of the Transfiguration as well as the day found back in the latter parts of Matthew 16, which McGarvey labels as the day of the sayings. In any case, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, up to a high mountain. After 6 days of having a heavy burden upon their minds, knowing that Jesus will go to Jerusalem, that he will suffer many things, and that he will be killed, these three need reassurance. They need to be shown the power God has over death. The mountain which Jesus takes them up to is not named in Matthew's account. However, geography and the location of Peter's confession in the northernmost region of Caesarea Philippi, has many people placing them on the summit or even one of the possibly lower peaks of Mount Hermon, a tall mountain with a summit of over 9,000 feet. It is here on this mountain that we read of this incredible account. These three disciples will now come to know firsthand with their own eyes that death is no match for God. In an instant, Jesus is changed from one form to another. Human skin changes to the bright radiance that is Jesus' divinity. Matthew describes that his face did shine as the sun and that his clothing was as white as the light. Mark states that his clothes were white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. Luke records that Jesus' face was altered and that his robe became glistening or sparkling or shining. Years later, this event is still fresh in Peter's mind as he wrote and remembers what he had seen on the holy mountain. For he received from God the Father honor and glory when there came such a voice to him from the excellent glory, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." 2 Peter 1 and 17. Also, one cannot help but to notice the similarities between Jesus and Moses. In Exodus 34 and verse 29, we can read that Moses descended from Mount Sinai and his face shined so brightly that Aaron and all the children of Israel were afraid to come near to him. But however glorious Moses was, it paled in comparison to the brilliance and powerful glistening white radiance that our Lord shone with. It was a reminder that someone greater than Moses stood before these three disciples. And I suppose that it is a reminder and encouragement to us that someday when time is declared no more, we too might be able to participate in such a transformation of our bodies. And speaking of Moses, we read that suddenly before these men appears Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. It is interesting that these two were chosen to appear alongside Jesus, not Abraham, David, Isaiah, or any other Old Testament servant of God. There are a couple reasons for this, though, and it is found in the identity of the two who appear alongside Jesus. Moses, as discussed, came down from Mount Sinai and was Israel's lawgiver. He mediated God's covenant with the people. Elijah was the ultimate example of the Old Testament prophet. John MacArthur, in his New Testament commentary, states that this prophet was zeal personified, a godly man of unmatched courage, boldness, and fearlessness. He had a heart for God, he walked with God, and more than any other Old Testament saint, he was the instrument of God's miracle-working power. By these two men appearing alongside and talking with Jesus, it is an assurance to the disciples who stand there, no doubt, in awe. This is how it is supposed to be. This is the path. This is the way that has been set up by God for his redemptive plan. In Luke 24, when the two unnamed apostles were walking to a nearby village, Jesus drew near and listened to their conversation, they, of course, not knowing it was Jesus. They explained the happenings in Jerusalem and how Jesus' body was gone and that angels had stated he was alive. Jesus then said unto them, "O fools, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken." Then later in verse 27, "And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures a thing concerning himself." Secondly, by Moses and Elijah appearing, it is proving that Jesus is greater than the law. In Luke 16 and 16, Jesus stated that the law and the prophets were until John, but since that time the kingdom is preached. John writes in John 1 and verse 17, "Law came by Moses, but grace and truth by Jesus Christ." Acts 3 and verse 22 calls back to a prophecy in Deuteronomy 18, when a prophet will come and take the place of Moses. Well, this prophecy is now fulfilled. We read that as these two prophets appear along with Jesus, that they were talking with him. Luke alone records what they discuss, and spake of his decease, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem. McGarvey notes that the word used for decease is the same term that we get Exodus, and he notes that it is an unusual word to use for death. But if you look at the similarities between Moses and Jesus, you will see that there are a lot of striking similarities. Moses led Israel out of Egyptian bondage. Jesus, in just a few short days, will lead his people out of the slavery of sin. Moses battled an evil and wicked Pharaoh, a man of constant lies and deception. Jesus battles the being who is behind the lies and the deception and this trickery. And at the end, both Moses and Jesus descend their mountain after speaking with God to press forward with their task. We do not know how long Jesus has been speaking with Moses and Elijah. We don't know how long the disciples have been standing there, maybe their mouths open in awe. But Luke does note that as these men, Moses and Elijah, were leaving, Peter realizes that this incredible encounter and experience is almost over. And so he blurts out in an attempt to prolong the event, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee and one for Moses and one for Elias." We know that Peter is just speaking out and not really knowing what he is saying, because Luke records that Peter speaks not knowing what he said. Excited, sore afraid, as Mark records, and realizing whatever this was that was happening before them is coming to a close, Peter is trying anything to keep them all there. McCarvey concisely records that Peter's fears overcame his discretion, but did not silence his tongue. Though he trembled at the fellowship of Moses and Elijah, he also realized the blessedness of it and could not let them depart without an effort to detain them, though the best delay tactic that he could offer was to build three booths, or arbors made of the branches of trees, for their and Christ's accommodation. By thus speaking, Peter placed Jesus upon the same level with Moses and Elijah, all three being worthy of a booth, all three being equal. Yet we can read that while Peter is speaking, God the Father intervenes before Peter can even finish speaking. There is no indication that Jesus even acknowledged Peter, but a response to Peter was still given, with God's thunderous voice and statement of, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." It should also be noted that the Father gives virtually the same message at Christ's baptism. God speaks about his Son in very endearing terms out loud so that the disciples, possibly so that at a minimum Peter, could hear. God once and for all straightened Peter up. For one, these booths that Peter offered to build hints at a retreat or even a delay from what lies ahead in Jerusalem. This is not going to happen. Secondly, by Peter offering to build all three of these booths equally, God specifically states that Jesus is his beloved Son. McGarvey states that spoken in the presence of Moses and Elijah, it gave Jesus that preeminence which a son has over his servants. He is to be heard. His words have preeminence over those of the lawgiver and the prophet, which ties back perfectly to why these two other individuals appeared with Jesus. However misdirected Peter's blurtings were, I believe he sort of got his wish, as we can read that before God's voice rings out, a bright cloud overshadows them or covers them. Now Peter, James, and John are in a foggy, hazy, but oddly illuminated environment. Luke states they are fearful as this cloud envelops them. And it is only fitting that God appears in a cloud. All throughout the Bible, God being enveloped or symbolized by a cloud has been a familiar part with all of God's children. God's glory was veiled in a cloud on Mount Sinai. When the tabernacle was completed, a cloud enveloped it as the Lord's glory descended. It was a cloud that led Israel by day, just as fire led by night. A cloud has always been a symbol of God's leadership. And during Jesus' transfiguration, it symbolized the same. God told these apostles, "Hear ye him." God's, no doubt, thunderous and just ear-achingly loud voice being absorbed into a cloud has driven these three men terrified straight to the ground. And I can't say I'd be much different in that scenario. Peter has been silenced, no longer babbling about building booths or even stating, "It is good to be here." I wonder if he regretted his words. Whatever may have been running through each of their minds, Jesus, in loving kindness, comes over to them and touches them, reassuring that he is still there. McGarvey notes that Jesus, as a mediator between man and God, removes fear. Jesus tells them to get up, to not be afraid. It's time to go. It's time to get to work. And there is a lot of work to do. Mark notes that as they lift up their heads and their eyes, they look around, and they see no one but Jesus in their midst. Elijah and Moses are gone. And it's a perfect end to this scene, an experience that these men have gone through. Jesus is the final authority. Hear him. When they lift their eyes, as Moses and Elijah have faded away from view, so do the law and the prophets, leaving only Jesus and his words as the final and ultimate authority. And Jesus immediately tests these disciples' willingness to hear him, or rather obey what he says or speaks, by telling these disciples to tell this vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead. For whatever reason, Jesus doesn't want this being discussed openly or being spread around. Would other men call them liars at experiencing such an incredible event? Would it have stirred up the Jews even more so and caused an even more expedited trial or crucifixion or just straight stoning of Jesus? We don't know, and we aren't meant to know. We only see that Jesus issued a command, and they obeyed. We now enter into the next section that is for consideration today. As they are coming down from the mountain, Matthew and Mark record questions concerning Elijah. His disciples asked him, saying, "Then why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus answered them, "Elijah indeed comes first and will restore all things. And how is it written about the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be despised? But I tell you that Elijah has come already." And they didn't recognize him, but did to him whatever they wanted to, even as it is written about him. Even so, the Son of Man will also suffer by them. Then the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptizer. What the disciples are referring to is the prediction of Malachi in Malachi 4, verses 5 through 6. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. He shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. What the issue is here is they are expecting Elijah the prophet to literally come before the great day of the Lord. The prophecy was not a literal one, but a spiritual one. The person that will turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to the fathers could not and would not be Elijah, but instead John the Baptist. We can read of this in Luke 1, verses 16 through 17. After the angel comes to Zacharias and informs him that Elizabeth will bear a child, and many of the children of Israel shall he turn to the Lord their God. He shall go before him in the spirit and power of Elias, to turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. I suppose it is understandable that they were confused, especially after witnessing such a spectacle atop the mountain. If Elijah must come first, why did he just now appear to them? They believe Jesus is the Messiah, and he has already been with them for 3 years, so their question is valid. Why do the scribes teach that Elijah must come first? Jesus answers them that the scribes are correct on this occasion. Elias truly shall come first. And by Jesus stating that Elijah will restore all things, he is paraphrasing what we just read in Malachi with a prophecy of turning their hearts. These aren't physical families they need reconciliation with each other. Instead, it is a spiritual relationship that needs to be fixed. Jesus continues to state that John had already come and had already prepared the way for those who will listen. Jesus knows there will be some, many, that will not accept him and his teachings and will refuse him. God never forces people to accept Jesus. It is always out of free will, and so many will refuse him. With John's arrival and his work and his foretelling of Jesus, it was good and successful for those who had the right heart. However, for those who rejected Jesus, swift and sudden destruction would come from the Romans in AD 70. Jesus says that they knew John not, that they did whatever they wanted to him. Some called him a demon. Others tried to discredit John, and finally he was murdered. Jesus once more reminds the disciples the suffering comes before the kingdom. Like John, Jesus will suffer. In Mark's account, he states that Jesus must be despised, or rather treated with disdain and scorn. Jesus continues to remind his disciples that suffering and death await him at Jerusalem. Only now do the apostles realize what Jesus all along has been speaking of. Elijah is John the Baptist. Jesus is the Messiah, and both will be put to death. Luke by himself records that on the next day, Jesus and his disciples come down and out from the mountain. And it happened on the next day, coming to the disciples, when they had come down from the mountain, he saw a great multitude around them, and scribes questioning them. Immediately all the multitude, when they saw him, were greatly amazed, and running to him, greeted him. He asked the scribes, "What are you asking them?" A man from the crowd came to him, kneeling down to him, and answered, "Lord, have mercy, I beg you to look at my son, who has a mute spirit, for he is my only child. He is epileptic and suffers grievously, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. And wherever a spirit takes him, it throws him down. He suddenly cries out, and it convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and wastes away, and it hardly departs from him, bruising him severely. So I brought him to your disciples. I begged your disciples to cast it out, and they weren't able. They could not cure him." Jesus answered, "Faithless, unbelieving, and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? How long will I bear with you? Bring your son here to me." They brought him to him, and while the child was still coming, he saw Jesus. Immediately the demon threw him down and convulsed him violently, and he fell on the ground, wallowing and foaming at the mouth. He asked his father, "How long has it been since this has come to him?" He said, "From childhood. Often it has cast him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out with tears, "I believe, help my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a multitude came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to him, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." Having cried out and convulsed greatly, the demon went out of him. The boy became like one dead, so much that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and raised him up, and he arose. Jesus gave him back to his father, and the boy was cured from that hour. When he had come into the house, the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why weren't we able to cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your unbelief. For most certainly I tell you, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you will tell this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. But this kind doesn't go out except by prayer and fasting." They were all astonished at the majesty of God. So Peter, James, and John come down, and straightway a large crowd has gathered. McGarvey notes that this crowd of people had been with Jesus until he ascended the mountain. The other nine disciples are surrounded not only by this crowd, but by the scribes who are now questioning them. They have them in, as McGarvey states, perhaps the only case where they had failed to cure and were making full use of the opportunity to discredit Christ and his apostles before the people by asking sneering and sarcastic questions. We don't know the exact questions being asked against the disciples, but Jesus' sudden return after being gone for a while has surprised everyone and made this crowd literally run to him, to see him at such a troubling time for the disciples, and an opportunity for this crowd to see how Jesus will handle it. It really kind of perplexes me that this crowd runs to Jesus. And to me, from reading this and the situation that is causing it, they are not running to Jesus to hear his teachings. They aren't there to be baptized or to change their lives. They are, as Brother Larry put it so well in one of his lessons, just fans. They want to see what is going to happen. This is entertainment, at least to some of them. Jesus asked the scribes, "What are you asking them?" Whether or not they were embarrassed or simply there wasn't enough time for them to answer Jesus, we can read that a man from the crowd comes and kneels and begs Jesus. He tells them that he brought unto thee my son. This father bore or carried his son with the intent of bringing him to Jesus. But instead he only found the nine disciples after Jesus had departed up into the mountain. Whatever beliefs this man had, he had faith in Jesus alone as he seeked him only. Even after the nine disciples could not heal his son, he still remained there. This is a demonstration that even today that some problems, some issues in our life, only Jesus should be seeked out. Only Jesus can bear that burden. This man recognized this and tells this to Jesus rather forcefully, interrupts Jesus who is trying to engage the scribes, and then tells of the horrible things that are happening to his son. This spirit is especially violent to this child. This demon causes the boy to have powerful episodes of epilepsy where he froths and foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth until the boy is just physically exhausted. Luke reveals in his writings that the spirit hardly departeth from him, meaning it is a near constant and exhaustive possession. This father is no doubt weary of the demon attempting to destroy this child by casting him into a fire to attempt to burn him or throw him into the water to try to drown him. In an attempt to drown him, yes, this is a very, very serious possession, one that threatens the actual physical existence or life of this man's son. Luke reveals that this boy is this father's only son. The man explains that very situation that caused the scribes to begin their verbal assault on the other nine disciples. He states that he brought them to the disciples, but they could not cure him. We know that the disciples have cast out demons previously. Just in the few months earlier in Galilee, Matthew 10 tells us that Jesus gave them power against unclean spirits and to cast them out. But this time, as we can read, for some reason, they are just not able to help this boy. Jesus in his rebuke gives us an idea about why this time was different. Despite being with Jesus for so long and seeing his miracles and hearing his teachings, their faith is still weak. They have been granted the use of that power by the Messiah himself, but the ability to use that power still relies on something more than just the pleading of a desperate father. Jesus then rebukes everyone in general. McGarvey, as well as other commentators, state this rebuke wasn't directed at the disciples, but it wasn't exclusive of them as well. McGarvey specifically notes that the perverse faithlessness and infidelity of the scribes had operated upon the multitude, and the doubts of the multitude in turn influenced the apostles. To me, in my imagination, the disciples become flustered. They become almost panicked when they attempt to cast out the demon from the boy, and nothing happens. The crowd jeering them and the scribes haughtily and pompously smiling before this crowd. Look, they are just men, and so too is this Jesus. They are defeated momentarily in their faith in this moment instead of having a conviction. But Jesus calls them out, "You faithless, unbelieving, and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? How long will I bear with you? Bring your son here to me." Jesus, as you can tell from these words, he's exasperated. This constant disbelief of the people must have been a constant grief to Jesus. Jesus essentially asked them, "Do you think I will be on this earth forever?" Despite his teachings, despite his training, and despite his love for these people, they just haven't progressed. They seem only interested in Jesus' physical miracles and not drawing closer to God. Jesus wants them to think beyond this plane of existence, beyond the here and now. He wants them to question what will happen to them and their souls when Jesus has returned to the glory of the Father. Despite this rebuke, despite of the weariness and the tiredness we hear in Jesus' voice, he is still compassionate. He is still loving and caring. Jesus takes the attention away from the disciples' failure. He takes it away from the scribes and their sowing of their disbelief, and he places it squarely upon himself when he commands, "Bring him hither to me." Mark and Luke both record that upon seeing Jesus, the demon just lashes out violently while the boy was still a bit of a distance from Jesus. In one last-ditch effort, the demon causes another violent seizure. Upon seeing this last desperate attack from the demon, Jesus inquires, "How long has this been happening to this boy?" And the boy's father replies, "Since his childhood." It is Mark that records that what we've already discussed, how the spirit has been just trying to destroy this boy. But it is what Mark then records the father saying that catches Jesus' attention. "But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus has just completed a verbal strike at this crowd, stating they are faithless and unbelieving. Yet this man, despite whatever faith he had to seek Jesus in the first place, still uses words that express doubt. "If you can do anything," or in the King James Version, "if thou canst do anything." Jesus immediately picks up on this man's doubt and feeds it right back to him. Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." I like how McGarvey explains this. He states that Jesus marveled at the disbelief of this Jew, which thus coolly and presumptuously questions the sufficiency of that power. In the remainder of his answer, Jesus shows that the lack of power is not in him, but in those who would be recipients of the blessings of his power, for those blessings are obtained by faith. And so immediately the father of this child cries out with tears, "I believe, help my unbelief." This is a painful cry for help from Jesus. First, he claims faith with the confession, "Lord, I believe." Secondly, he recognizes his faith is weak with the statement, "Help my unbelief." It is a clear sign of honesty from the father that Jesus could help his wavering faith. And so we read that Jesus rebuked the spirit, ordering him out of the boy's body and to enter no more. The defiance that this demon has in his removal is stark, as mentioned, compared to other demons in past. Upon its removal, one last violent action of eviction, the demon caused the boy to convulse so greatly and so terribly that the crowd was convinced the boy had died. But Jesus took him by the hand and raised him up. Jesus then gives him back to his father, and we read that the boy was cured from that hour. When imagining the scene in my head, I can't but help to see how it is very close to what happens when someone becomes a Christian today. We, like the boy's father, confess verbally. The father here makes a statement of faith that he believes that Jesus can heal his son. We make a statement of faith when we confess that I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Jesus commands the evil to come out of the boy, and upon that exit of evil, the boy becomes as if he were dead. In our baptism, the old sinful person dies in the watery grave. And when it was done, Jesus took the boy by the hand and raised him up, essentially a new creature, as this demon had constantly plagued this boy from such a young age. And no doubt, this father feels as if he now has a new son, one that has been gone for so long, one has been missing. It's like a new creature, a new son. We too are raised up out of that watery grave as a new creation, a new child of God, one that was once missing, but yet now is. And I also cannot help but notice that in all of this, it was Jesus that was required. Man could not save this boy, but instead it requires the Son of God. And that translates perfectly to our situation today. Man may offer promises of salvation their way, but only Jesus Christ and his plan of salvation can make us rise up as new creatures. After all of this excitement and demonstration that Jesus had made, no doubt the crowd was thronging and loud and boisterous and remarking about what they had just seen. He could not make an important point to the disciples with all of that going around. So we read that Jesus had come into the house, wherever this house was. His disciples came to Jesus privately in the quiet, now that they have, and said, "Why weren't we able to cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your unbelief. For most certainly I tell you, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you will tell this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." McGarvey has an excellent summary of this perplexing question the disciples present to Jesus and his answer back to them. The failure of the disciples was not because of any insufficiency of power in Jesus, but was due to their own failure to appropriate that power by faith. The relation of belief and unbelief to miraculous power is fully illustrated in Peter's attempt to walk upon the waters, as well as being tossed around upon a stormy sea. And it is unfortunate that this will not be the last time they will suffer from this crippling issue. At Jesus' arrest, these same disciples will flee into the night shadows, abandoning their Savior. There are two ways one can interpret Jesus mentioning the mustard seed. One is the idea that it grows from the tiniest of seeds into comparatively a rather large herb. Another way to possibly interpret is that faith, even as little as small as a mustard seed, can be a powerful thing to possess, so much that Jesus states that nothing will be impossible to you. With this explanation that they did not have enough faith, Jesus then states that this kind, meaning this particular demon, required more faith to expel it. McGarvey writes that prayer was the means of increasing faith. Demons, like spirits in the flesh, have different degrees of will force, some being easier to subdue than others, and this one, being particularly willful and difficult and hard to expel, required more faith to expel it. The final section or topic we want to cover this afternoon quickly is Jesus returning to Galilee and again tells of his death and resurrection. Again from the composite gospel, "And they went out from there and passed through Galilee. He didn't want anyone to know it. But while they were staying in Galilee, all the people were marveling at all the things which Jesus did. So Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let these words sink into your ears, for the Son of Man is about to be delivered up into the hands of men. And they will kill him, and when he is killed on the third day, he will be raised up.' They were exceedingly sorry. But they didn't understand this saying. It was concealed from them that they should not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this saying." Going forward from the transfiguration and the healing of the boy, Jesus and his disciples passed through Galilee. The scriptures tell us that Jesus didn't want anyone to know that they were going this way. Jesus wants to separate himself from the large multitudes that constantly follow and crowd around him. Jesus wants to spend time alone with his disciples, and the reason for this follows in the text. Jesus reveals to them yet again that he will be betrayed and that they are going to kill him, but also that he will rise again on the third day. Mark and Luke record that the disciples do not understand Jesus. Luke further explains that it was hidden from them so that they did not perceive it. Matthew records that they were exceedingly sorry. They became emotional and sad. They do not ask further questions, either due to furthering their sadness or to even prevent further disappointment. These disciples are still shocked, as Peter was, that their Messiah is about to be murdered. And when reading this, it makes me wonder if this attitude of not wanting to ask questions is a possible result of the severe rebuke of Peter. Luke records in verse 45 that they feared to ask him of that saying. It is possible, at the risk of another rebuke, that they may have been too frightened to further inquire to Jesus what he meant. That's just one theory, though. McGarvey has a differing one, and he simply states the disciples regarded this subject as delicate, and combining with their own overwhelming sorrow, shrank back from wanting to know it more fully. Again, Peter's experience taught them not to attempt to correct Jesus while thus speaking. So there was nothing left for them but to grieve at his words. It was just too much for them at that time. And really, this does make a little bit a sense here. We are all human. We all know that sometimes we just have our limits in the face of bad news. And these disciples were certainly getting some bad news. We need time to digest or to compartmentalize things before being able to focus on and moving forward. Whatever the reason, Jesus is now fully preparing these disciples for what is to come, that he will be delivered into the hands of men and telling them that his death is drawing nearer day by day. This concludes my assigned sections today, and so concludes my lesson. I hope that what I have studied and presented to you this afternoon has been informative and helpful and been beneficial in this series of studies. We never want to close a service without offering the gospel invitation. We know as you hear the word, you must believe, you must repent of your past life sins, you must confess with your mouth that we discussed that I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and finally be baptized, immersed into that watery grave, arising as a new creature. If there is one who has taken these steps but has committed a sin that has brought shame or reproach upon the church, Jesus is our mediator. We have read that today again. He will go to God, to the Father, if we go through him and we pray for forgiveness. So if there is one of either case, please come while we stand and sing.